Welcome to episode 72 of Frank Reactions, the show where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tema Frank. If you missed last week's episode, you may find it interesting to go back. I interviewed David Berkus, whose book, Under New Management, discusses a lot of the things that I talk about in the internal people section of my new book, People Shock, The Path to Profits When Customers Rule. So if you want to catch that interview, go to frankreactions.com/71, or of course, just subscribe to the podcast and then you'll get them all. Speaking of People Shock, just a quick update before we get into today's interview. It turns out there's a certain irony here because I keep talking about the Amazon effect and how great Amazon is for customers and how it's really raised the bar on customer service. Well, it turns out it is great for purchasers, but it can be a lot more frustrating for vendors who are trying to sell through it. Someday I will write about all these experiences I've had trying to get the various versions of PeopleShock up on both the Canadian and the American website. But I can tell you for now, it is finally up for pre-sale on Amazon.ca. And if you do purchase it there and send me the receipt, I will right away send you the PDF version of the book so you don't have to wait for the final version to come out and you can start reading it right away. I hope it will also be on Amazon.com within the next couple of days. But if it's not, you can at very least go to peopleshock.com and there you can download the introduction and the first chapter free. There are some other bonus materials that I've been sending out and will be sending out. And of course, you'll be notified as soon as it is available on amazon.com as well as .ca. So that's it for the little advance advertisement. Now let's talk about today's interview with Adam Toporuk, who has written a great book called Be Your Customer's Hero, Real World Tips and Techniques for the Frontline. Adam is a third generation entrepreneur and has worked a lot in retail and franchising. So what I really liked about his book is he's got a very realistic, hands-on approach to how do you deal with customers and the reality of customers who can sometimes be quite unreasonable. Enjoy the interview and I'll chat with you briefly at the end.
I'm Adam Toporuk. I am a customer service author, keynote speaker, and the owner and founder of CTS Service Solutions, which is a workshop and training company specializing in high-energy customer service workshops. And we teach organizations and frontline teams how to deliver hero-class customer service.
I gather, Adam, that you have a background in retail yourself. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I come from the franchising space. I'm actually a third generation entrepreneur. So I'll start with that. So grandfather had a small Main Street shoe store. My father was in retail and then he had a wholesale distributorship when I was growing up. And my mom owned a retail children's clothing store. And I've owned numerous companies and small businesses over the years. Spent a good bit of time in franchising and retail, and a lot of those lessons that I got both growing up in business and in small business and from my own experience are what inform the things I teach and talk about in customer experience and customer service. So I come from that small business lens as opposed to sort of the large corporate lens. But being in franchising has been a really interesting experience and really helped me have a dual lens because I get to see the big company side, how hard it is to execute at scale, what those challenges are, and then the small business perspective, which is, okay, every dollar I put towards customer service comes out of my kids' mouths or my rent. So it better work. It better produce an ROI. And how can I structure, you know, my customer service, my customer experience, and not just, you know, you just don't have these big budgets. You can't just throw money at it. You have to be very strategic about it.
Absolutely. You talked about franchising. Tell me a little bit about what some of those challenges are in trying to get consistently good cross a customer experience and customer service throughout a large multi-branch or franchise operation.
You know, franchising is truly one of the most difficult places to create a customer experience change because you have individual owners, but you also have a corporate office. So, you know, if Starbucks says we're going to change this at our 10 gazillion stores, all they pretty much have to do is say it. And then there's a mechanism to make that happen. I'm not saying it's easy. It's a big project by any means. But you don't have these stakeholders who have their own money invested, their own opinions, who aren't employees but are sort of subject to the direction of the corporate office. So franchising, there's a political aspect to it that's different than sort of the traditional silo politics we all experience in large organizations. So one of the things I think is very important in making customer experience changes, whatever they may be in a franchise organization, is explaining the why and getting the buy-in.
Right.
It is crucial, because if you just send it down from on high, if you just say, we did our study up here at the corporate office on the 500th floor, and this organization said we need to do X, Y, and Z, so you all need to do X, Y, and Z, and by the way, it's going to come out of your pockets, not ours, at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the challenge with franchising. Who's spending the money on that change, and what is the benefit going to be? So with franchising, I think there's a real need, and there's of course a need for this in any large organization, but even more so for transparency and explaining the why and getting that buy-in. Because we all talk about, you know, if you talk about Starbucks, or you're talking about getting buy-in at every level of the organization, but a lot of times you're talking about the employees. Here you're getting the buy-in of independent owner-operators and employees. You have two different separate distinct, not only layers, but mindsets.
Mm-hmm. From what you've seen, do many franchises actually have systems set up so that the company doing the franchising, that they actually do get feedback from the franchisees about what they're experiencing on the front lines?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, the one thing with franchising that's very interesting is you have a very wide variety of franchises. There's thousands and thousands of them.
Yeah.
And they're at different life stages and they're different life cycles. So the developed franchises, the big brands we all think of, yeah, of course, they have. Most of them have great systems for getting franchisee feedback. Now, in some cases, and I haven't experienced this personally, fortunately, but you know, in some franchises, as we know, it's very adversarial. These franchise networks have a lot of problems. There's franchise organizations that are literally in litigation with the franchisor.
Yep.
And so there's a whole different level of, you know, in that case, there's a different landscape than, let's say, a franchise where people are doing well and there's a generally, you know, there's always problems, but there's a generally harmonious attitude. There's not a, it's not a raft of lawsuits and, you know, turnovers and things like that. And I think in those organizations, the ones that I'm familiar with and the ones I've seen, there are really good mechanisms for getting customer feedback, and there are usually good mechanisms for getting franchisee feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think there's the challenge for all of these organizations is, how do you blend the two? Because they're sometimes at odds.
Oh, yeah?
Well, yeah, because you have to look at one of the real big issues in franchising, and when you're delivering a customer experience, is literally, is it coming out of the corporate office's pocket or is it coming out of the franchisee's pocket?
Right. Yes.
Okay. I mean, I won't say which brand it is. I saw a brand, not one I'm associated with, do a television commercial a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically saying, please notice, if you see an old sign on our building, our franchisees haven't changed that sign yet. And, you know, most people, they packaged it well, and nobody who wasn't in franchising or really in business a lot would have noticed. I was just like, wow, they just kicked their franchisees in the teeth.
Yeah.
I was like, it's obvious that, you know, the franchisees weren't excited about this rebranding. And Literally they did a public, used a national ad campaign, and it was very interesting. So you have those dynamics, and I think that's a different level of challenge. And we were talking about going back to the customer feedback and going back to the franchisee feedback. I think when you can blend those, and when you can, again, sort of wrap it into a neat package and push it back down to the network and say, okay, here's what we've learned, here's what we think, here's what we want to do, and here is why.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can make the pitch, you can make the sale, and you can get the buy-in. I mean, anything, right? Any large company, any network, you're going to have your percent that it doesn't matter what you do.
Yep.
Right. Just forget that. But you know, big picture, yeah, you can do that.
Okay. So let's get into a bit of the book. And the name of your book again is?
Be Your Customer's Hero, Real World Tips and Techniques for the Service Frontline. Excuse me.
You start the book with the whole notion of the line about the customer is always right. And you're saying, well, that's not always true. So let's talk a little bit about that. And one of the examples you give later on in the book is this mythical story about Nordstrom accepting somebody returning a tire, a product that they didn't even sell. Can you talk a little bit about this notion that the customer is always right and about how Nordstrom actually deals with things now?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you know, you've been in the game for a very long time as I, and that Nordstrom story has been floated around forever.
Yes.
So, for those of your listeners who may not know, basically there's a story that Nordstrom accepted tires, yeah, which they've never sold, and that's how great their customer service is. And I go into the book that it's basically not proven. It's most likely mythical. And it's been used as an example of great customer service and outlandish customer service. And, you know, if somebody comes to your hair salon and returns a set of jeans, you should take it back. Right? And it's ridiculous. That's not the real world. So the example I use in the book is in Nordstrom's real world, and they are absolutely by far one of the best customer experience companies ever.
Yep.
In my lifetime, for sure.
Yep.
But even they have limits. In the real world, they have limits. So they, it's called, what's it, wardrobing. Okay. So people will come in, try on, buy a prom dress, wear it to prom, leave all the tags on, right? And then bring it back the next day. And they've got special tags and special things that you really can't, that doesn't allow that to happen. Hmm. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier the small business lens. I think small businesses are acutely aware of these types of issues. And in the real world, you have to find a balance and you are going to have to say no. Now, where I think the challenge is for small businesses is that they often go too far the other way.
Right.
And I often tell a story, and when I talk about employee empowerment, I tell a story about how, you know, when I opened my first retail business, I was, you know, I had all these controls and these things. And if somebody wanted a refund, they had to do X, Y, and Z. And I later loosened the reins and empowered my employees, and my customer experience went up, my employee happiness went up, everything went up. So you can absolutely be penny wise, dollar foolish.
Right. Actually, I remember one of my first bosses saying to me, I was working in banking at the time, and we were doing a promotional contest. And he said, you know, no matter how carefully you write the rules, about 2% will try and scam you. And so don't worry about them. Design for the other 98%.
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I say the same thing.
Exactly. So then how do you make the decision about how far to go and what's appropriate? I mean, I got into a big argument with a company here from which I had been. I'm quite short. And so I go to petite stores to buy clothes. And there aren't a lot of petite stores around. So, you know, they kind of recognize me by this point. And I had bought, I don't know, several hundred dollars worth of stuff. And then one pair of jeans I think I had bought. When I got home, I concluded they really didn't fit right. But I guess I had taken the tag off. And so they were trying to refuse to accept them back. And I was outraged. It was clear they hadn't been worn. So where do you draw those lines, and how do you decide how much is appropriate?
There's no hard and fast rule, but I'll give a couple of guidelines, because it is going to be different in every business, and it's going to be different in every product. You know, some products, certain types of food, you know, or whatever, you may not be able to take back.
Yeah,
and
legally.
You have to decide if you're just giving a refund, yeah, essentially. So, you know, I think one thing to take into account is how well you know the customer. What is amazing to me is how many companies and organizations will do this to good customers, long-time customers,
yeah,
customers that have been there for 2 years and have never done anything.
Right.
What are they, a scam artist all of a sudden? You know, I mean, that's beyond comprehension to me, is some of those decisions that are made. So I think one is to take into context the customer themselves and what type of customer they've been.
Now, part of the problem there, just to interrupt you, is, you know, when I think of the retail sector, so the sales clerk who was on duty the day that I came back didn't know me. On the other hand, their records presumably would show that I am a regular customer. So partially, I guess it's a question of what kind of backup systems do they have.
Well, you know, that loops me back to the empowerment thing I'd mentioned earlier. So I'll talk a little bit about that, because I know it's actually an integral part of this. I mean, finding where the line is going to always be context dependent. Mm-hmm. But here's one thing I definitely advise. I believe hugely in employee empowerment. And one of the things I talk about is I use a phrase called smart empowerment. Mm-hmm. Because I do believe there are limits. When you read some of these things online and, you know, the experts about employee empowerment, it's just like, oh, yeah, give every employee everything. They'll always do the right thing with it. No,
yeah.
That's not happening. So I talk about smart empowerment. So if you have a cashier in a retail business, you're not going to give them the ability to wire funds from your main account. That's not right. Okay. There are limits. So the question is, where is that line? So one of the things I did, I talked about when I had my first opened a retail business, I had all these controls and I was like, this is ridiculous. I've got people coming to me for a $7 refund and they're going to my manager. I'm like, this is insane. The good thing was I woke up pretty soon. It took a few months. I'm like, what am I doing? You know, I came from just a traditional business school and traditional business upbringing, just like, you know, controls, control, control, control. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is ridiculous. So what we did was we decided what a level was in that business. And there were five or six things that the employee could do up to a full refund. And every employee was empowered to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in the case of your clothing store, it could be every employee is empowered to refund, return, anything up to $100, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Right. And you say, for that, you figure out what a level is where you're just not going to bother anybody.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's the first. Start with that because that's easy. Just decide this is the level which I don't care if there's, you know, and you keep records. If somebody comes in four times.
Sure.
And right. You know, I mean, it's obvious they're scamming you. The other thing I would say is give customers the benefit of the doubt the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in an appointment business where you have cancellations. And when you have a cancellation, that's a big issue. And do you charge for the cancellation? A lot of people do. A lot of people don't. A lot of people do if you abuse it.
Yeah.
And we were sort of from the if you abuse it standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because it's hard to find the line. And
for sure. Now, you've touched on another issue there about, you know, if this person is doing that kind of thing repeatedly, brings us to the issue that you also raise in the book about the importance of documentation. And I know, having been in a business where I hired people to develop software, that it's a classic example. Software developers hate documenting what they've done because they feel it's boring and it's a waste of time. And I'm sure a lot of people in busy small businesses feel the same way. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of documentation and how to manage that process so that it doesn't just overwhelm you with bureaucracy and paperwork?
Oh, God. I had such a hard time even getting those chapters in the book.
Really?
I mean, well, because I was traditionally published. They were great, but I really had to, like, make it really tight. I had more on documentation than made it in the book. Because it is so boring. Nobody wants to document anything. Who does? I hate it. It's the worst part. Because if you're already busy, documenting what you're doing just doubles it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's miserable. Nobody likes documentation, but it is so, so important. And one of the reasons it's important is, as you pointed out, the person who's servicing you may not have been the last person who serviced you or the last 10 people who serviced you.
Yeah.
And just that alone, just for frontline customer service, forget every other aspect of it, liability. Mm-hmm. Okay, knowing whether there's a pattern in the context of what we're discussing, is somebody taking advantage of you? When you go in the records and you say, oh, wow, this is her fourth return where she said she it was ripped when she got home, right? She pulled up in the jeans and the knees were ripped when she got home, fourth time in 6 months.
Right.
And now you have that record. Now you know. And you're also not relying on paranoid memory of people. Because mm-hmm. people like to see patterns. You know, I've had, oh, we changed the music. And I actually wrote a blog post about this years ago, this sort of anecdotal evidence. We changed the music. Oh, God, everybody hates the music. So I drill down. Okay, how many complaints did you get? I got one. How many complaints did Jenny get? I got mine from Jenny, actually. So it was one complaint, right? You're telling one person out of 2,000 has complained so far.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So one of the things record keeping and documentation does is helps alleviate some of that effect and some of that anecdotal, the way our minds remember things conveniently. And the other part about documentation is it truly helps you on with the customer themselves. Because, you know, if you've worked in any type of retail business, any type of service business, you've inevitably had the customer go, well, it's been 3 weeks and nobody's contacted me.
Yeah.
Okay. We've sent 4 emails. We've called you 3 different times. Mm-hmm. And we spoke to your husband.
Yeah.
Right. And if you don't document, you don't know that. And I teach in the book and be your customer's hero. You may or may not use that information depending on the conversation. The point is not to prove that you're right.
Yeah.
But the point is also to prove that you have been trying and to sort of shut down that idea of, oh, well, y'all haven't been doing anything. Well, actually, we sort of have, but that doesn't matter. We want to help you right now.
Yeah.
And that, so documentation, it's so boring. And it doesn't have to be elaborate if you're not in a liability heavy type industry, or, you know, something where you've really got a lot of regulation or liability concerns. It doesn't have to be elaborate. I mean, documentation can be very quick. I believe in the book, I actually sort of talk about some shorthand ways to document quickly.
Okay. And then the nice thing is, too, if you've been doing that, I guess from a marketer's perspective, you can then look back and, well, not just marketing, even production or whatever, process perspective, you can look back and say, okay, there are some trends in what we're seeing here. And it implies we do need to make some major changes in how we're doing things, which could easily be missed if you're not documenting.
Right. You use that unstructured data, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You also talked in the book about assuming accountability for follow-up. So somebody calls you with a complaint, at some level that the person taking that call, if I've understood you correctly, should be assuming responsibility for making sure that the follow-up happens. So how do you make that a reality in organizations where there are different people responsible for different parts of solving the problem?
Well, it was actually forgive me, but it's actually assure accountability, which is different than assume accountability.
Ah, okay.
And so what that means is to assure accountability is to tell the person that I am going to be accountable for this. I'm going to be accountable for helping you. So, Tema, I'm going to absolutely, and if I'm not the person handling it next, then what I'm going to say to you is, Tema, I am committed to you, and I'm going to make sure that I get you to the right person.
Okay.
Okay, so if I'm not able to be accountable for the resolution, then I'm going to be accountable for the transfer.
Okay.
I'm going to give you that confidence that, you know, one of the things I talk about is one of the service triggers I talk about is being transferred or shuffled.
Oh God, yeah.
Which we all love, right? We all talk about that in customer service. And it is truly a trigger because we are all so hair trigger ready to just jump. As soon as somebody says, well, you got to call the other 800 number. We're like, right. So one of the things assuring accountability does, or, you know, a lot of times we talk about in CX, a warm transfer, is it gives them that comfort level. It's like, I have somebody on my side. I'm not just going to go into the ether. And that comfort level, because the minute you say, oh, well, you need to talk to customer service, you need to talk to accounting, and you just give them a number, or you just say, in a small business context, yeah, that's for my manager. I'll leave a note on his desk. Right?
Yeah.
And you're like, and as soon as that happens, the customer, what happens? Their defenses are going up. They are already becoming defensive. They're already becoming ready to be disappointed. And if you can assure accountability, then you can lower those defenses or keep them from even coming up in the first place and give them a sense of confidence. Now, the key to this is you actually have to deliver on your assurance.
Right. So you need to actually make sure that your frontline staff know who they should be transferring people to?
Well, that's – yeah. If you're talking about frontline, I think one of the key things with transfers is training.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I've been – I tell this story sometimes in one of my keynote speeches where I was sitting in my driveway on the phone with a very large national bank who will remain nameless. And my wife drives past me, and I've got no cell service at my house, so I can't go in because I don't want to lose a call. And I've been on this call for an hour and a half, and I am on the seventh person now, literally the seventh person. My wife drives by me. Actually, I think I was on the fifth or sixth when she drove by me. Drives by me, goes in, parks. I don't know. 40 minutes later, she comes back out.
Are you alive?
Drives back by me. I wave to her again, point to the phone, because I'm a prisoner in my own driveway. Because I was like, I think I have somebody who finally knows what they're talking about, who finally seems to understand. I am not going to, you know, I'm going to grasp you with my cold, withering fingers and never let go. And that's how people are. And that's what everybody, we all have had that experience. I mean, if you've had any experience in life and have engaged in this economy in any, you know, a house or renting an apartment or a bank or whatever it may be, a power company, you have dealt with this somewhere along the line, and you're most likely, that's why I talk about service triggers and be your customer's hero. It's an automatic trigger for most of us.
Yeah. And so service triggers, you mean things that trigger anger or upset in the customer's mind?
Yeah. Things that we are automatically predisposed to just like flip over a switch. As soon as we see it happening, okay, boom, bad experience is happening again.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately is contact centers and call centers. And we know that as there's more and more involvement, let's say, in social media with issuing complaints or trying to reach customer service, the number of channels that they have to deal with is just growing and growing and growing. And call center work was never particularly pleasant to begin with. So from your perspective, what are some of the challenges? And have you seen some companies that are actually managing to do it well? And what are they doing to try and make it more feasible to deliver great service through a complex call center setup?
Yeah, companies that are doing well, I can't really name any right now, but I can name what the experiences I've had.
Okay.
And tell you what I've experienced, because I honestly, life is a blur. I can't remember who it was with sometimes.
Sure.
So a lot of what I think people are doing well is simplifying menus. Yeah, everything now is a balance between cost and function. Okay, right? It's how much are we going to automate this and annoy people, and how much are we going to pay to have humans do more of it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's an ever tension, and it has been since the day the first call center opened.
Yes.
Right? So there's always that tension. And I think what people are doing well, they're, first of all, using technology that is advancing to do better at the technological side.
Mm-hmm.
So I've experienced a few very smart phone trees, you know, that seem to get you to your answer pretty quickly.
Okay.
Or get you to the right person. But they still aren't great. Don't get me wrong. they're still not great. But I'm just realistic. There's just a certain, if you are a multi-gazillion dollar company, you're going to probably have a phone tree. You're so big.
Yeah.
It's so hard to route. And what I've seen people doing wrong is the same things that they've always done, which is you go into phone tree hell and there's no escape.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally I can't remember who it was. And I would call them out. I don't call companies out by name very rarely, but I was so annoyed. If I could remember who it was, I would call them out right now.
Yeah.
It was literally like, sorry, we can't help you. Click. And it hung up on you. If you didn't get to the right answer, it literally hung up the phone and told you it was doing so. We were disconnecting the call. I was like, what the heck?
Okay, bye-bye to that customer.
Bye. But on the personal, on the human side, so let's talk about call centers again. You know, call centers are now, we talked a lot about social. I know you had Jay on talking about hug your haters. I mean, there's so many channels. And I still think phone is a hugely important channel, but it needs to be viewed as part of the entire mix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more a part of the mix than it is the sole solution.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you've got social customer service, you've got email customer service, you've got live chat customer service, which is replacing a nice chunk of the phone business.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got phone, and in some contexts, you have in-person. And with phone, I think one of the best things, the places I've had the best experience on the phone in the last, let's say, 3 years are where the people have been incredibly trained. What you got on the phone was so much better than what you got via social, of course, because of the depth of the channel.
Right.
Or via email, because email, the problem with email is it doesn't allow for easy iterative conversations, right? You answer me, and now I have four more questions, and now it's a whole nother.
Yeah.
So our evolution has not kept up with our digital evolution.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is we are still wired from the jungle. Okay. We are still wired to respond to human faces and to body language, to tone of voice. And every time you strip away one of those signals, the potential for connection goes down and the potential for misunderstanding goes up.
Yes.
Okay. And so one of the things I say, every channel has its purpose. And obviously, if somebody wants a quick answer on social, you don't need to set up a 4-hour Skype call to fix it. You just respond.
Right.
But there are times for the more complicated, the more difficult the issue, or if you want to make a deeper connection, I always recommend going to phone or to video.
Well, video, I think, is really coming on stream now.
Exactly.
As a way of dealing with that.
because there you get everything except you get most of the face to face. It's not quite the same as being face to face, but you really can, you know, you can see the person's face. You can see when they're pausing that they're actually thinking about what you said and not checking their phone.
Right.
I mean, all of these things. And so when you're asking about call centers, I still think call centers are very important. I just think they are shrinking in, you know, their place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just each company is going to have to find the adequate place for it. I am concerned with the move that sort of says, well, we don't need them anymore.
Yeah, and you do.
Yeah, I mean, we still need phone. I mean, there are some things that are just maddening to deal with digitally.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, companies can certainly help themselves a fair bit with having a good website that answers a lot of questions and makes it easy to find the right answers. But one of the things that I always advise people too is if you've got even an automated system suggesting answers, always have the backup option saying, if this isn't what you were looking for, call us or email us, or here's how to reach somebody, a real person, you know?
Yes. Well, exactly. Because if you, there's, you can never answer every question.
No.
You just can't. I can tell you, you had a small business and 10 years, and the last day before I sold the thing, I can tell you we were getting questions we could never have thought of. We're like, how on the earth have we done this? This is a new one. This is amazing. This is so out of left field. And you will always have those. And I think that's why you're always going to need a human who can negotiate the gray to figure out those tricky answers.
Yeah, which I guess brings me to PeopleShock, my book, that no matter how sophisticated our systems get, the automated systems, fundamentally, there will still be times where you need a human because we can't program for everything. And even artificial intelligence, there's a lag.
Well, exactly. I mean, you talk about in PeopleShock, the 3P profit formula. And one of your 3Ps is, you know, promise, process, and people is the middle one, right? It's people.
Absolutely.
It's so important. And I just had my first experience with an artificial intelligence email service.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not encouraging.
Yeah, I think it's like so many of these things. It's a little oversold at the beginning.
We're not there yet. And I think humans are always the place where you find connection. We're still built to connect to humans, not to computers. And the place where you can still figure out the things that are outside of the normal process and the normal journey. And that's where all the real customer service happens anyways.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably a good place to end, but I will ask you my standard ending question, which is there anything that you wish I had asked you and I haven't?
No, not really. I'll just appreciate it. This has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I'm really loving your book. I just started it, so thank you for sending it to me. But I'll just say you can find me at customers@stick.com. Anybody wants to reach out, I love connecting with new people, and I'm all over Twitter and LinkedIn. So feel free to reach out. And thank you so much for having me, Tama.
Thank you, Adam. Look forward to seeing you in Atlanta. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. And please, you know, cut me some slack. I couldn't resist leaving in there his comment that he was really enjoying PeopleShock. And just a reminder, if you do want to get that free chapter of PeopleShock, go to peopleshock.com right now, and that can be on its way to you. And if you would like to read the whole book even before it comes out, you can pre-order it from amazon.ca. So just go there and search PeopleShock, and hopefully within a few days it will also be available on amazon.com. So if you pre-order, just send your receipt to tema@frankreactions.com, and I will send you the PDF version instantly. There will not be an episode next week. I'm going to be traveling to Atlanta for the Customer Experience Professionals Association's Insight Exchange, and I'm really looking forward to that. But between that and trying to get the book ready and doing a bunch of interviews with me on the other side of the mic, I just will not have time to put together another episode for next week. So I will chat with you in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, you can always just go back and listen to some of the episodes you missed. Have a great couple of weeks. Bye.